Okay, now we just need to wait for me to find Psalm 12, and we should be ready to go. Okay, the subject this morning is the trustworthiness of the transmission of the Bible from its original inspired writings down to us today. Let's look at Psalm 12, and we'll begin reading at verse 6. Psalm 12 and 6. The words of the Lord are pure words, like silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified seven times. You shall keep them, O Lord. You shall preserve them from this generation forever. So it's the second of those verses that I'd like to mention in particular. You shall keep them, that is, your words, O Lord. And we get that from the previous verse that it's talking about his words. You shall preserve them from this generation forever. Now, the way some Bibles translate this, it implies that the thing preserved will be his promises. That is, that God keeps his promises, and that's certainly true. What I'm focusing in on this message is this reading, that is, that his word shall be preserved from this generation forever. And we're talking about the Bible, that the Bible would remain and remain untampered with throughout generations. So part of the inspiration for this came from interactions that I've had with Muslim people. On the East Coast, we tend to see Muslims a little more often than you see them here in the Midwest. In the Midwest, it's a rarity. I did talk to Brother Jeff this morning. He says he encounters them more on the university campuses, but it seems that every year, the presence of Muslims on the news, at least, gets more and more common. And the acquaintance with Muslims, considering that there are getting close to a couple billion of them in the world, is going to become more and more a reality. Now, if you have had interactions with Muslims, it can be very frustrating to talk to them. And they have an argument that really never loses. Wouldn't you love to have an argument like that? The argument that never loses. If you ever get in trouble, you can pull out this argument and you know that it will never lose. Wouldn't you love to have an argument like that to talk about with people? They have one. And it goes something like this. They say, oh, well, we believe Jesus was a prophet. Oh, you do you? Well, wouldn't it be interesting to see some things that Jesus said? And you turn to things like, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Things like that. And then they say, that is not what Jesus said. This is the argument that never loses. That is not what he said. You say, well, it is what he said. It's right here in the Bible. No, Jesus never said that. You have a corrupted Bible. The church came in and changed it and wrote that he said that, but he never said that. Well, it never loses, no matter what you give him. No, that's not the true Bible. The true Bible never said that. You're just saying that. The church put that in later. Oh, it'd be awfully nice to have an argument that never loses like theirs. If they get to know just out of the air what was put in by the church and what was not, then they, anytime they need it, they can just reach to it and say, oh, well, the Bible didn't say that. You have a corrupted Bible. And virtually every Muslim person that I've talked to and have asked the question, have you heard that the Bible has been changed over the years? They always say yes. Now, the emphasis this morning is not merely how to better witness to Muslims, because that may cover a small portion of your Christian life or maybe a small portion of the people here. These are things that we need to know anyway, whether a Muslim has challenged us on the topic or not. It's good for believers to know. It's particularly good for younger believers to know. And I know that there's a teen class going on and so on. So if you have been established in this, and this is not new for you. Why are we doing this today? And the answer is, we need to be able to simply and clearly explain this to others, young people in particular, when we go back to our home assemblies. Should the occasion arise, should the question come up, a young person comes and says, how do we know? I'm hearing these things. Somebody's raising this objection. We had an atheist in our when we were having our Bible study at the University of Maryland, and she seemed to be saying that, oh, well, it's we know the Bible has changed over the years, and in fact, we were able to explain how we know it has not. So a conversation I had in particular with a Muslim fellow at the University of Maryland, we started talking about the Bible and the Quran in terms of how it was transmitted to us. And during this conversation, he asked me four questions about the Bible, all of which I had to answer no. You'll see the questions in a moment. And every time he asked a question and I answered no, I felt a little bit smaller. Now, what we're going to find out is that contrary to initial thinking, the answer no is the best answer I could have given. You'll see the questions in a moment. You'll see that I answered no to all of them. It sounds at first like you don't want to answer no. You want to answer yes. But what we're going to see throughout this study is you really want to answer no, and answering no gives us more confidence that the Bible has not changed. And it's going to be very counterintuitive, but hopefully by the end you're going to say, wow, yes, that's right. I want to answer no, and the answer is, in fact, no. So the first question he asked me is this. Do you have the originals? So when I read from the book of John, do we have the original book of John that John penned being inspired by God? For how many books do we have the originals, by the way, of our 66 books? None. We have none of them. Do you have the originals? I had to answer no. He said, well, we do. We have the original Quran. Now, that's debatable in and of itself, but that's not our issue at the moment. That's what he said. Do you have the originals? I had to say no. His next question, do you have 100% agreement in all the manuscripts that you do have of the Bible? Do they all agree completely? To which I slunk down a little lower in the chair and said no. He said, all of ours agree 100%. We'll get to that later. Third question, do you have a means to trace the pedigree of a manuscript back to its original? So if you have a handwritten copy of the Bible, does it have, say, a little registry up at the top that says, this one was copied from that one, which was then copied from that one, which was copied from that, which was copied from the original? That way you can know which ones are the authentic ones and which ones are these cheater ones that have made their way in. My answer? No. Fourth question, do you have a system in place that destroys errant copies to ensure that errors do not propagate to copies further down the line? To which I, in a much quieter voice now, answered, no. Having thought about it more, and I wasn't at the ready with him at the moment, answering no to all of these is what you want. And we're going to see through this study that that's true. Now, you might agree with some of these right away, but you might say you're hard-pressed to say that the answer of no to number one is what you want. But I'm going to set out to do just that. That's better that we don't have the originals. Now, that's a real challenge for me. We'll get to that quite a bit later, though. That's to leave you hanging or something like that. All right. So let's think about how we got our Bible and what safeguards God has in his wisdom put in place through history to ensure that we know that the tampering has not occurred. So let's think about how we got our Bible. So at some point, a book of the Bible was written. And for the sake of being specific, I'm going to use the book of John for no reason in particular. So here at the top of the screen is the original book of John that John penned. Now, there is a name given for the original penned book of the Bible. And the experts who deal with these things have a name for this. It's called an autograph. So if you're talking with somebody in the subject of how the Bible was preserved, so if somebody uses the word, well, we don't have the autograph, you say, well, wait a minute, what is that? He didn't sign it or something? No. It's just the name for the original writing. It's called the autograph. Now, we've already mentioned, for how many books of the Bible do we have the autograph? Zero. So I'm going to change the look of this from being a rectangle to being this dashed rectangle. We know it existed, but it's not in existence today. All right. So what happened from the autograph? I mean, how did people get by in the first century, the second century, and so on? And how is it that they were able to read the Bible as it was written? Say, let's talk about the New Testament in particular. The New Testament, being written during the first century, was used and read by first century believers. How did it happen? Not everybody went to one location to read the autograph, and we know that the answer was it was copied. So it was copied. Somebody made another copy of it. Somebody made another copy of it. Good. What happened then? Copies were made of those copies. And copies. And copies. All right. There we go. So lots of copies. What happened after that? More copies. There. Whew. A lot of copies. I could have done this on a whiteboard, but we would have spent most of our time with my drawing this picture. Well, that's the end. No, it's not, because after that, there were more copies. Yeah. There won't be more copies displayed on our screen. That's it. What does this look like, by the way? Do you recognize a picture like this in any other context other than copying the Bible? It looks like a family tree, doesn't it? And it's a very good analogy of a family tree, because we all make our way back to Adam. We all make, all the copies make their way back to the original somehow. Now, we may not know all the details, but this would have been a copy of that, which would have been a copy of that, and to the original. Think of children from offspring. Now, there is a big difference between this and the propagation of children through generations. And that is the distance between one copy and another, the distance in time, can be great. There's no problem in, if, as long as you can read a 500-year-old copy, there's no problem in making a copy from it. Unlike children that have to be compressed in, 25 years, 40 years, 50, sometimes more, All right. So these distances can be long, so it's possible that there aren't so many hops that need to be taken to go quite a distance in history, in centuries gone by. Now, the Bible was propagated like this through hand copying. Hand copying, as we know, is subject to people making mistakes. If You might have preferred that the Bible had been written at a time when the printing press was already invented. Then you can make lots of copies, and the printing press doesn't make mistakes. Well, at least it doesn't make different mistakes than the first one. See, it's actually a blessing that the printing press was not invented. Because think about what would happen. If somebody were copying and they made a mistake here, what would happen to that mistake? It would be duplicated down here and down here, right? But the impact of the mistake will be localized to this one and its children. The mistake will not infect the entire set. Now, we'd prefer it to be down here than up there, in which case it would infect more, but the whole idea is that if we had all of this information, we would clearly know that the mistake occurred here and infected those, and we would be able to tell from the others that what had happened. With a printing press, you do not have this luxury. If there were a mistake that occurred in putting the Bible into a printing press, that mistake would be replicated everywhere. So it's a blessing. More nefarious, if somebody got in and tampered with the Bible at the printing press stage, how many copies would have evidence of that tampering? All of them, and therefore you would not be able to tell that there was tampering. So it's a blessing that they had to be handwritten until the time of the printing press, and then, which was somewhat 500 or 600 years ago, and then copies didn't just cease in a moment, just like when the first automobile was created, people didn't in a moment stop riding their horses. There was a transition period. So for a transition period, people kept writing them by hand. Now, this idea that a printing press, if there's a mistake, it will be propagated everywhere, this has happened today. On one of the online versions of the Bible, a word got put in by mistake. I think it was like instead of though, it was through. There was an R that was put in or something like that. And a brother in our assembly found this mistake in reading in the Old Testament somewhere. And it's like, no, it's though, it's not through. And wrote to whoever it was that maintained this online Bible. The person said, well, we've looked into the matter and this copy agrees with the copy that's used here and used there and used there and used there. And he's like, well, yeah, it agrees. They all are using the same electronic copy. You just send it from one to the other. It's the fact that they all agree does not bolster the case that it's right. If the online one is wrong, all the copies of it are wrong. Happily, it's not a huge mistake, and it was not in a very popular translation. So I think the church will get by. But you understand the dangers of it. Now, I do have a technical matter here. Everything's showing up in black and white. My X's were red, and I noticed last night things were in black and white. Is that curable or is that not curable?
No, we have to change it out. It's not working
out of one, so. Oh, so we got black and white.
Yeah.
All right, this is in dazzling color. anyway. So. All right, so this is our setup. Now, do we have today all the information that I'm showing on this picture? Aside from the original. And the answer is no, we don't. One of the things that we do not have most of the time is we do not know necessarily where these connections are. The sticks that I have drawn, we generally don't know. Occasionally we will know where a copy came from, but usually the case is we don't know. So with hopefully great fanfare, I will you will see these sticks fade away. This is a big achievement for me to be able to get that to work. Now, what happens with the copies? Is this what we have today? And the answer is no. A lot of these copies have disappeared. So let me see if... Whoops. No. Come on now. Oh, all right, let's see. So something went wrong, but... Oh, wait a minute. I know what went wrong, maybe. Let me go back a little bit. All right. Let's get ourselves to here. All right, so... How many of these do we have?
5,000.
Yes, 5,000.
Sorry.
Yes. So we don't have all of them. A lot of them are missing, as shown in this picture.
How many do you think there were?
That's unknowable. That's a good question. I would say at least 5,000. I don't know. I don't know. How many do we think there were? We've got 5,000 existing today. I don't know. My answer was I think at least 5,000. But so this is talking now about New Testament only. When I use this number, I'm talking about New Testament. When I say 5,000, I mean 5,000 complete copies of the New Testament. I'm not talking about individual books for which there are more. Not too far into the church, about the year 400, roughly, the Bible was translated from Greek into Latin, and we have several thousand in Latin and some in other languages as well. The oldest complete New Testament, the same way we would see the New Testament today in English, but the oldest complete New Testament would be about a few hundred years after the time of its original writing. But we have individual books that go older than that, down to, say, like 150 years after its original writing. And we have fragments of books that go back to about 35 years after its original writing. And this doesn't count now letters that people write back and forth to each other that we have some. So somebody would be writing and they'd be saying, you know how Paul wrote about, and then they would write, for by grace you have been saved through faith and that not of yourself, something like that. So in this letter, they're quoting the Bible, even though that letter is not necessarily a copy of the Bible. So to give you an idea of how impressive this is, not only that there are 5,000 of them, but that they move back so close to the original writing, writings of Plato, for instance, you hear about in university, there are less than 10 existing copies. And the oldest of them is roughly 1,000 years after the time of its original writing. And yet you don't go into university and have them say, these things that we say Plato said, he probably didn't say them at all. We just have these copies that are so far removed from the original, and we only have a few of them. There was a historian that lived in the ancient world named Herodotus. We have less than 10 copies of what he wrote, and they are about 1,000 years after the original writing. And yet nobody is saying, these things he wrote, we really have no idea that whether he wrote them at all. And yet with the Bible, with this kind of evidence, nonetheless, people start challenging, do we know whether that was what was written? So in contrast, you can see the power of this. Now the question is, how, given this, do we come about to have the Bible that we have today? Well, the first job is to take the existing copies that we have and from these to build the original. I don't think I'm helping my case at all when I say how good it is that we don't have the original. I don't think I'm helping my case in saying what we need to do. Because you would think, wouldn't it be much easier just to have the original? Well, more on that later. I'm, again, trying to build suspense. All right. Let's say we have the job, and it's our job here at Turkey Hill to reproduce the Gospel of John. And we do not have the original. All we do is we have these copies of John, some older and some young, more recent. But we have these copies, and we are to use these to build the book of John. Now, can we do it? Who has little kids? Can we do it? Yes, we can. Very good. If you have little kids, you understand. But think about it. I have seen the original Constitution of the United States. It's in Washington, D.C. I've looked at it through glass. If the Constitution today were destroyed, would we be able to know what the Constitution said? Sure. Zillions of copies and all this. Okay, yeah. That, I mean, you understand. It would not be some unrecoverable loss. The same thing is true now. So how do we do it? Well, we're going to get all these copies and we're going to compare them. So we're going to have a little election. These copies all get to cast a vote, and they are going to vote on the first word of the book of John. Now, these copies are in what language?
Greek.
Now, we're not counting the Latin copies at the moment. So these copies are in Greek. So they are going to vote in Greek what the first word of John is. Now, we're going to do it in English, as if they were written in English. Okay. So we look at the copies, and we look at the first copy we have, and the first word is in. The next copy, in. In. In, in. In, 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 in. The vote is 5,000 in and zero for anything else. What do you think the first word in the book of John is? In. There we go. Whew. Let's do it again. Let's vote on the second word of the book of John. And this time, it's not unanimous. This time, 4,999 say the next word is the. One says the next word is beginning. So the first three words of them all say in the beginning, except one that just says in beginning. Oh no. We can't possibly know what the next word is now. It's not unanimous. The answer is yes, we can figure, okay, so it's in the. And we work our way through the whole book this way. Do you know there are people that do this? You wouldn't want to meet any of them. But it's actually a bigger science than I'm making it sound like, because there are different views as to how this might be done. So some views are, let's let everybody have the same vote. Other views say, wait a minute, the older ones, maybe we should weigh more heavily because they're older. Others say, no, not such a good idea. It turns out that the different views of how to do this really doesn't make a lot of difference. It makes some difference here and there, but it really doesn't make a lot of difference. So there is a maybe more of a science to it than just a straight-out vote, but that's how it will be done. Now, these things, all of these copies, what do we call these? These handwritten copies. They're all called manuscripts. Now, what is this thing called that we're building? Now, this is not the autograph, right? The autograph was the original written one, right? But we are building something that is not any of these manuscripts. It's not the autograph, but it is the recreation of the autograph from the information given in the manuscripts. There ought to be a name for this thing that we're building. And this thing is called an edition of the text. Or sometimes people just say a text, but that's a very generic word. It applies, everything's a text. So this is an edition of the text, and the reason that edition is underlined is when the root word of edition is edit, right? It means that there is human involvement here. So that humans came and they looked at the manuscripts and they created an edition of the text of John. And this is a key part in how we have our Bible in front of us today. So what has happened to get our Bible to us is that there were these manuscripts, lots of them. These were taken by people, and from that, an edition of the text was made. This is the thing that we built in the beginning. Word by word, we built this, or somebody built it. And for the New Testament, this thing was done in Greek. Is that the completion of how we have our Bible today? No, because what language is this in? Greek. So you can get a Greek edition of the text today. And people, I bet some people in this room own them. But that's not our Bible yet. What happens then is people take the Greek and translate it into our English Bible. Or, note, this job doesn't have to be redone if you want to make a Spanish Bible. Do you understand? You can translate from the original Greek into Spanish without redoing the job with the manuscripts. And you can make a Russian Bible and an Arabic Bible. Now, in our thinking, we need to separate these two jobs. There is one job that goes from the manuscripts to the edition of the Greek text. It's another job to go from the Greek to the language of the Bible we're translating into. We need to have these two jobs separated in our minds. It's helpful. So what do you call, or who are the people that do this first step, taking the manuscripts and getting an edition of the Greek New Testament? The name of these animals would be textual critics. That's their name. They carefully look at the texts, that is, the manuscripts, to create this edition of the text. And the one we're more familiar with is going to be the second step. What do we call the people who go from the Greek into whatever language they're writing the Bible into? They're translators. Okay, so we want to keep these two steps in mind for how we get the Bible in front of us today. Now, through the example that I gave, copying of looking at all of these copies and having them vote on what the words were, I very carefully chose my numbers to say, it was 5,000 to 0. It was 4,999 to 1. And I did that so that everybody would nod their head that, yes, the first word was in, the next word was the. The question now is that what it's always like? Is it always such a lopsided vote that there is no question as to what the original was? The answer is, the good news is, it's almost always the case. That is, it's almost always the case that the vote is so lopsided that there is no question in any reasonable thinking person's mind, probably including the atheists. They would probably say, yes, yes, there's no question there. Are there ever cases where it's in question? And the answer is yes, there are. There are some rare ones, and we're going to look at one as an example. Come to Revelation chapter 1. Revelation 1, and if you can see in the lights after having been turned down, we may get some input here. So Revelation 1, and we're going to look at the last part of verse 5. Revelation 1, 5. Okay, let's all get there. To him who loved us and from our sins in his own blood. What did he do? To him who loved us and did what with regard to our sins? He washed us. Does anybody's Bible say different than washed? Yours says freed us. Released us. Anybody bold enough to have loosed us? Loosed. We have a loosed. All right. We have a loosed on the loose. And so in these various readings, we have all of these words. Now, how did I do that? Loosed, released, freed, and washed. Why are they different? Now, you people who know more than one language, first I applaud you. I am still struggling with English. But those of you who know another language and have ever had to translate something into the other language, you know that it's a little tricky business sometimes. It's not necessarily exact word for exact word. And sometimes you've got all kinds of problems that we're not going to go into at the moment, but should I translate something released or freed? Well, they both mean about the same thing. Which one really catches it the best? Does loosed kind of mean the same as freed? Yeah. Do they both kind of mean the same as released? Yeah. Do all of those mean the same thing as washed? No. What is happening here? Why are these three a little bit different from each other? And the answer for those three is their differences in translation from Greek into English. The reason one says loosed and one says released has happened where? Where in this picture did this difference come from? Translation. In other words, people saw the same Greek word, and one translator said, I think that Greek word is best captured with the word loosed. And another also well-meaning and competent person has said, I think released captures that Greek word. And one said, I think freed captures that word. These are differences in translation. And in almost every verse of the Bible, you will find differences in translation. From one version of the Bible to the other. Okay? But you cannot explain this one from a difference in translation. This one, it turns out, is a difference in the Greek text, meaning that the Bibles that say washed are translating a word in a Greek edition of the text that is different from the word that these three are using because they're using a different text. This is one of the rare cases where the vote of those manuscripts was not so lopsided as to be without question. This is a case where the vote was in question enough that some textual critics who made an edition of the text said, we think the right one is this Greek word. And others looking at it said, no, I want to weigh the vote differently. I want to give the older manuscripts more weight. And that little difference is going to mean I choose a different word there. I'd like to tell you what the two Greek words are. One is luo, and the other is luo. Could you imagine a room full of slaves copying the Bible, and somebody's reading, so one person's reading up front, and everybody's got a copy down? That's the most efficient way of copying out the Bible, the fastest way. Instead of having everybody looking like this, you have one person reading and a lot writing. You could imagine getting to Revelation, the person's reading luo, and this guy thought he said luo. How could you make that mistake? Or maybe he said luo, and the person wrote luo. Kind of a luo or a luo. Yeah. So enough copies said one, enough copies said the other, that two editions of the text read slightly differently. And because of that, the translators, when they translated, those that used the one edition of the text had one of these words, loosed or released or freed, however they wanted to translate it. The other one had washed, because they had the different word in the text. Now the question is, which is right? Which one is it?
Loosed.
One says loosed. That's my answer, too. I don't know. Let me ask you this. Have we been loosed from our sins? Have we been washed? My question now is, there's not a theological problem with either one. My question to you is, can you live with that? Can you live your Christian life from here to the time you're called home, not knowing which one it was? And the wonderful thing is, there is never a significant doctrine that we hold to that hangs in the balance on one of these votes, on one of these differences in the text. There are some differences. There are some cases, and they're rare, happily, like this, where if you put a gun to my head and said, well, which is it, Craig? Which one's right? I would have to say, I don't know. But the wonderful thing is that God has so designed and preserved his word through the generations that we do not worry that any significant doctrine that we believe is hanging in the balance based on the question of which one it is. And that's the wonderful thing. Now, knowing how this all comes about, I now want to try to tackle some of the questions with regard to the New Testament, and we are going to say some things about the Old Testament. They're going to be much briefer, more brief. Anyway, do it more briefly. We will do that, and it's going to be a very brief mention, but I'm sticking right now again with the New Testament, and we'll deal with the Old Testament separately. So I want to come back to the Muslims' questions. The four questions that were asked, all of which I had to answer no to, and I want to now try to defend why we should be happy that we answer no to all of these. And as we go through this, Lord willing, you'll be delighted at how wise God was in preserving his word just the way he did it. That's my hope. All right, here's our map of how it was we recreate the original. And here was his first question. Do you have the originals? Do we have the original John as he wrote it? And the answer is no, we don't. Why is this a good thing? If we had the original John today, what would we really have? Say, it's a dumb question. If we had the original John, we'd have the original John? I'd like to submit that if we had the original John today, what we really would have is the claim that we have the original John. How would you know it was the original John? You would trust the people that said it was the original John. Are they trustworthy? I don't know, but you would have to trust somebody. You're going to see the original. You can go see it in a museum, say. You look at it. Oh, that's the original John. How do you know it's the original John? Well, we know it's the original John. We know because the church kept it and gave it to us. They donated it to the museum 300 years ago, and we've been keeping it under glass ever since. Would that make you feel more comfortable? What did they do with it when they had it? How do you know somebody didn't sneak it behind the curtain and scissor out a chapter that they didn't like and bring it out and say, oh, the original John? And if there ever was a copy somewhere that was uncovered that differed from it, well, get rid of the copy. We have the original. The original is right. Having an original implies there is a centralized location where it exists. And if there's a centralized location where it exists, what could people do with it? Tamper with it. It's hard to imagine how you could have any assurance that what is claimed the original, one, is the original at all, and two, that it had not been tampered with anywhere through all of the centuries. Well, we've had, you know, ten people from different religions all in a room 24/7, changed out very carefully, like the changing of the guard, all watching it to make sure that it has not been tampered with. And we've been doing this for 300 years. What about the 1700 years before that? We would not know. In fact, it's because of that that I actually like the way we have it and the way God has in his wisdom allowed it to happen. Because who has control over the manuscripts? No one entity. Suppose you decided that you were going to launch a campaign to change the Bible because you didn't like what was in it. Would anybody ever do such a thing? Suppose you launch this campaign today to try to do it. How successful could you be? Suppose you did it several hundred years ago. Let's say in the year 800 you wanted to do it. How successful would you be? The problem is, one, you can't get to all of these. And two, if you, by some miracle, were able to get to all of these, what would you do about the ones not yet discovered? Problem is, they're still being discovered in buried houses and buried churches. Other buried, I mean, they crop up now and then. That number 5,000 isn't changing very fast, but it is changing a little bit. Occasionally, people will find another one. And if you think about in the year 800, suppose we don't know in history really what was going on then when it comes to the Bible. So what if somebody managed to get hold of all of them and change them? The problem is nobody can get a hold of them all because they don't know where they all are. And they've been uncovered through time ever since. So nobody, the lack of centralized control over them is a method of preservation and a method of ensuring that nobody can get hold of it and tamper with it. They've been found on different continents, over different time periods. even in different languages. Now, there are two other side benefits to not having the originals. One is, if there were the originals, whatever church owned them would put itself up as the true church. We're the true church. We have the Bible. Right? No, nobody would do that. And it also has the effect of keeping people from maybe worshiping the paper or parchment or whatever it would have been written on originally. But as far as what we're concerned with, the chief benefit to not having the original is not having centralized control. Not having centralized control means tampering is possible, and not having it is superior. Do you have 100% agreement in your manuscripts? This is question two, to which I had to answer no. Now, my Muslim friend I was talking to was very quick to say, we have 100% agreement in our manuscripts. I said, really? Yes, 100% agreement. Not one copy has any word out of place. No. Really? Could you give me a piece of paper right now? Because I'm going to make a copy and make a mistake in it. And thereafter, you will never be able to say 100% of the manuscripts agree. He said, well, that would not be a true copy. Oh. Well, we'll talk about this. This matter of voting, these copies essentially vote on the wording, is a very interesting example, because there was a vote taken in a country some years ago. The vote was taken in Iraq by Saddam Hussein. After the vote was taken and millions of votes tallied, Saddam Hussein came out and announced to the people, I have achieved 100% of the vote. 100% of the people voted for me. That instills confidence in you, doesn't it? That was a fair and untampered with election. If 100% agreed, what would it be almost sure evidence of? Tampering. Incidentally, with my Muslim friend, he had given me an English, what they call, meaning of the Quran. See, with them, the only true Quran is in Arabic. But if they have an English copy, they say, well, it's the meaning of the Quran. It's not the real thing. And there was a mistake in the published copy. Now, it wasn't in the words, but it was in the chapter numbers, what they call chapters. They use a different word. But it went, you know, 1, 2, 3, 2, 3. Like, so there's no mistake in this one? No. And I showed him on that. He said, well, that's a mistake. Well, yeah. Well, no, that's a mistake. That doesn't count. That's just a mistake. All right. The fact that not 100% agree is evidence that there has not been tampering. I would be afraid if there was 100% agreement. We're going to see this play out a little bit more, but for the moment I'm going to go on with this voting and 100%. I'm going to go on to the next objection. Do you have a means to trace the pedigree of a manuscript back to the original in order to know which copies are authentic? We don't want these unauthentic copies. We want authentic copies. That sounds like a noble effort. Or do we? Which do you want? A means of tracing out which ones are authentic, or no means of tracing out which ones are authentic? I want no means. For this reason, If we labeled some of these as authentic because we trace their pedigree and others not, if we found other manuscripts and they showed evidence of tampering, what would be done with them? Those are not authentic. No, these are the authentic ones, and it allows for centralized control. What we have with the New Testament is undocumented copying of them, which is a beautiful thing because it means nobody can figure out where to go to get hold of the authentic copies to tamper with them. It's hidden. You don't know if somebody over there made copies of it. If it were all in a structured, traceable system, you would know that they didn't, or if they did, they would be discounted as not authentic. This is happening without, you don't have to ask permission to make another copy of the Bible. Nobody has to register it anywhere. It's uncontrolled happening, and nobody can get their greedy, sinful hands on it to be able to change it. They're being found in caves, they're being found in kitchens, they're being found in libraries, they're being found in homes. They're being found everywhere, and nobody knows where the next one's going to arise. You can't get your hands on them. This is a benefit, how there was no centralized control over its copying. And finally, do you have a system of destroying errant copies to ensure the errors do not propagate? And there is no formal system in place. There was a vote taken in the year 2000. This vote was for the President of the United States between George W. Bush and Al Gore. Everything came down to Florida. Yes, all of the votes were tallied, and the difference in votes was so small that just a little error once in a while in counting could make all the difference of who was president. Naturally, teams of lawyers were flown into Florida as soon as possible. Recounts were done, and they were counting these in the millions, and they were counting these in the millions, and both stacks are almost identical. It's going to come down to a razor-thin margin. Everybody was holding their breath as the numbers were released after the recounts. Just a few votes could make the difference. When all of a sudden, the lawyers turned and saw in the corner a stack of ballots. What are those? Well, they're ballots. What are they doing there? We need to get them counted. Oh, no. Those ballots were no good. They were errant ballots. They were wrong. What do you mean they're no good? They're wrong. Well, you know, some of them were turned in and the person didn't vote for anybody. I mean, that's not a good ballot. You've got to vote for somebody. Others, people voted for both candidates. That's not a right ballot either. So they're wrong. Do you think that the lawyer said this? Oh, okay. The lawyer said, get away. We want to see those ballots, and we will decide for ourselves whether they are errant or not. And they did. Could you imagine if instead of that, all the lawyers were looking at the two stacks trying to see who won, and somebody looked in the corner and saw a pile of ashes. Said, well, what are those ashes over there for? Oh, those were the wrong ballots, the errant ballots. So we burned them. You did what? We don't want to keep good ballots around. I mean, errant ballots around. What if they accidentally got counted or something? It's best to destroy them. They would forever have put a question mark on that election because the lawyers would have objected to high heaven saying, no, You are allowed to put those ballots aside and label them as wrong ballots, but you leave the ballots alone. And then we will come and examine them and agree with you that they are errant ballots. But you do not destroy them and have us just depend on your word that they were errant ballots. Do you understand? And this is what has been done. There are errant copies, and we know where they are, and we say, well, this one's an errant copy. We don't destroy it. We label it as such and leave it there. So anybody coming later can also say, oh, yeah, I looked at it myself, and I agree. Yes, that one's clearly an errant copy from somehow. That instills confidence, not destroying any contrary evidence. No wonder you claim to have 100% agreement. Anything that doesn't agree with what you think it is, you destroy. Well, that makes it easy. All right. 10:31. I owe you a minute. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the way you've preserved your word, and we pray that the study will continue to be helpful for us as we look into further things of preservation and how it was translated to us. In the Lord Jesus' name, amen. Tomorrow, Lord willing, finish up some of this and then talk about the next step of how we went from copy to translation in our hands today. Okay.